You are listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
The Paranormal News Insider from ParanewsInsider.com. Produced by WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of June 13th, 2017, and episode number 317. And this is your host, as always, Dr. Brian D. Parsons, and welcome. It's warm. It's warm. It's warm here in Ohio, where I'm broadcasting from, and it's also very warm in this little teeny tiny studio here. So if I pass out, let's see, it's 73 degrees right now in here, so I'll be keeping an eye on that. If I pass out, then you know why. But anyway, this week we're going to be talking about the wow signal again. I know you thought it was over, didn't you? But no, there's some little controversy behind this going on right now, and we're going to talk about, can we survive an alien attack? And something you is in the news. You might, I don't know if you know this, but big event taking place tonight. NASA is going to control the weather tonight. Yeah, talk about that. We're also going to get a little off topic, and it's kind of on topic but off topic at the same time. Doppelgangers, but we're talking about real people and a doppelganger leading to freeing a wrongly accused man. We're also going to have the book of the week. Excited about this one. Yes, Ron, tonight is the night. Great book for the book of the week tonight. I'm really excited to bring you that one, and hopefully I don't forget about it like I sometimes do. And this week's news is brought to you by Thomas Francis University. Thomas Francis University is a metaphysics school that offers online spiritually based bachelor's, master's, and PhD doctoral metaphysical degrees, as well as single standalone courses in related metaphysical and esoteric topics. Instructors are easily accessible and offer world-class customer service and instruction. TFU and other ICMH schools have hundreds of students and graduates in more than 50 countries worldwide. For more information on Thomas Francis University, please visit tfuniversity.org. And I haven't taken a look at, yeah, I know I'm a little slow today. Have not looked at my events page to see if I have it. From over the weekend, I sometimes forget that. No, it's not. So I got a little updating to do here, I see. So that's not completely up to date, but I always recommend that you check out the events page. I added a few days ago. Let's see. June 6th. So it's been about a week since I've updated this site. But there are plenty of great events coming up that you might want to check out if you're into such a thing. I think they're fun. I think they're exciting, and I love to speak at those as well. Speaking of that, I'm going to be speaking at the Kecksburg UFO Festival. I'm really excited about this. I've never spoken at just a UFO-based convention. I've done a lot of coast-to-coast events. Am I allowed to say that on the air? Well, it's too late. I already did. Events dealing with fans of the show, and I've gotten to speak at some of those events. And some other UFO-related stuff, but never a conference. And this is a pretty big one. And if you've never been or never heard of the Kecksburg UFO Festival, it is a festival. It's kind of like a carnival atmosphere. There's a parade. There's hot dogs. It's incredible. And it's a three-day event. Well, 2.5 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The speakers are on Sunday. But the action is all weekend long. You've got to be there Friday night. You got to be there Saturday as well. I mean, bring the kids. There's a ton of stuff for children at the event and adults alike. I mean, there's just so much going on. It's overwhelming. And it's a little teeny, teeny, tiny town. It's small. There's really not much. If you go too fast, you're going to miss Kecksburg. But as soon as you see the glint and glare of tinfoil hats, you know you've arrived. I actually saw quite a few of those last year, amazingly enough. But it's a great time, and there's going to be some awesome speakers this year. And by awesome, I mean Stan Gordon. I mean, the guy is a legend in Pennsylvania. He's going to be talking about some new information as well as some historical information in the state of Pennsylvania. And I will also be speaking. And I'll be talking about the foundation of UFO research and investigation. It's on a book that I'm still trying to get done, hopefully in time for the convention. I don't know if it's going to make it. But either way, that'll be out probably early fall at the latest. Schneider right here on UCJV Digital Broadcast. So Kid Radio, 16 Colin. Yeah, he is going to be talking about Cryptozoology 101, which is you talk about lately. So that's going to be kind of cool. And like I said, I'd like to share this with Colin. I've had numerous events, but never been at an event where we've spoke at the same time. So that's going to be really exciting. And another guy, Ron Murphy, which we're going to be talking about him a little bit later on in the show. About his book of the week. Yeah, he's got a book of the week this week. And he is an awesome researcher. And if you get the chance, I don't care if it's at Kecksburg or not, you've got to find Ron somewhere out there. And you got an excellent presenter, awesome information, and better yet, buy his books, numerous books. And again, we're talking about one tonight. And he's talking about the unexplained world of Chestnut Ridge, a Western Pennsylvania's Goblin Universe. There's a book on that, the Chestnut Ridge that he's written. And that is very, very close. It's in the neighborhood of where we're going to be at. And Kecksburg obviously is the home of where a UFO reported a time ago. We decided 1965, December. Yeah, December. I got a shirt. I got to read the shirt. But the speaker lineup is great. And the great thing about that is they change people up year to year. So I won't be heartbroken if I'm not asked to speak again next year. Hopefully I will be with the book coming out. But it's good. They keep it fresh. They keep it interesting. And they rotate people through. And it's great. But like I said, the whole entire weekend is just exciting. Hot dog eating contests, truck burnout contests. My goodness. It's just the carnival food. You name it. It's there. Carnival rides. It's just an awesome time. I mean, you've got to get a shirt. I mean, nothing says I enjoyed my time doing something or I was here than a t-shirt. I mean, forget pictures. Who needs pictures? You need t-shirts. Yeah. And PA stuff, Pennsylvania. I spent a lot of time in Pennsylvania. I'm only, I don't know, like an hour away from the border. Ohio-Pennsylvania border, and spend a lot of time over there. There's a lot of fantastic researchers and investigators out there, a lot of great minds. Not that there's not that many in Ohio, but it just seems like there's a good concentration of fantastic people over there in Western Pennsylvania. So I tend to hang out there a lot, and I'll also be speaking on August 5th at the Strange Encounters of Pennsylvania event in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And a couple weeks later, I'll be back in Ohio. August 19th, I'll be at the Goose Project 2.0, the MS fundraiser at Prospect Place Mansion in Trinway, Ohio. We'll talk more about those events as we get through June. I mean, we got to get through June first. I mean, June is a month, not first. We've already passed June 1st. I'm having a little bit of Chicago flying humanoid Mothman Owlman. There's nothing going on. I'm a little withdrawal with the story. I was hoping to report something this week. It's quiet. The skies over Chicago have been quiet for a few days now. And the only thing that I've seen written about this was Lon Strickler mentioned that he's now calling it, his official name is the Chicago Phantom. Chicago Phantom. Henceforth, that's what it's going to be called, I guess, at least through Lon. It's confusing, too, because you have the flying humanoid. You have the Owlman, which I like. I think that's cool, Owlman. But there is an Owlman in the United Kingdom. So it's a little – you don't want to step on too many cryptid creatures' toes and cause people to get all upset if you start printing T-shirts and putting stuff on there about the Chicago Owlman, and then somebody in England gets a little upset about that. And then Mothman, people have referred to this as the Mothman. Well, you know, Point Pleasant, you know, they're going to get a little upset about that. So it's a little confusing about this whole entire story. But the Chicago Phantom, I like that. That would look great on a T-shirt. And I don't have any cryptid news. I know there was a few stories that I saw here on the network. They were talking about the story out of cryptozoologynews.com, I believe, about the bodiless legs that were walking around in some cases with that. I still don't know really what to think about that. It's kind of weird. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. Okay. UFO news. We'll just jump into UFO news. And wait a minute. Oh, no. Audrey left. Anyway, UFO news. Antonio Paris. We've been talking about this since January of 2016, right here on the Paranormal News Insider, about Antonio Paris and his hypothesis that the WOW signal of 1977 was caused by a comet. Now, when he first talked about this back in 2016, that he was going to conduct experiments, there was a lot of people that kind of laughed at that and said, there's no way. It's not going to work. It's not going to explain anything. You're crazy, essentially. But now that Paris has published his work in the Journal of the Washington Academy of Sciences, there are now even more people that do not agree with his findings. And it's kind of becoming a bigger story than him purportedly solving this. Right when he published this work, a lot of people came right out and said, oh, this is solved. Now there's a bunch of question marks. And the WOW signal in 1977, it was very controversial because a lot of people felt that it was contact from intelligent extraterrestrials. And some people obviously didn't. Although beyond the confusing signal, we were left with nothing else. No repeating signal, no logical solution to what the source might have been. They were able to eliminate some close proximity things, satellites, microwave ovens and different things. Yes, microwave ovens. There was a signal found once that was repeating and a SETI program, and they found out that it was a microwave that was causing it. Well, at least they figured it out. I didn't claim it was Zeta Reticuli or something. But now that the dust has settled on Paris's claim that he has solved the near 40-year mystery, the controversy is back. It's back in full swing again, just like it was in 1970. And you'd think that people would be happy. Okay, it's over. It's done. But there's a lot of views, I guess. A lot of people are raising some questions with the study that Paris conducted. And some of these people are very valid researchers in different fields. Alan Fitzsimmons, an astronomer at Queen's University Belfast, whose specialty is comets, stated that the comet 266P Christensen is a quiet comet, even when it's closest to the sun. Yet Paris took his readings, and it was twice as far away, or over 4 astronomical units away from the sun. And let me explain that real quick. Astronomical unit, for those who are not aware, is about 93 million miles, or obviously roughly the distance from the Earth to the sun. It's just a better way to define the greater distances encountered in space as compared to using the same units we use on Earth, like kilometers and miles. It would just be numbers that would be mind-boggling. So they use astronomical units. And Fitzsimmons also points out that a 1,420 megahertz emission has never been detected from a comet before, and therefore concludes that Paris's conclusions are, quote, rubbish, unquote. Rubbish. Rubbish. Love that word. And, you know, 1420 megahertz, that's what the signal was detected as, and that's what Paris got from these comets, even after he moved the satellite away and then moved it back. This is what he got. So questions are still there. Now, other astronomers and researchers agree that these measurements are questionable. Paris has answered these claims by saying, quote, astronomers have not detected hydrogen emission from comets because there has not been research specifically on this subject, unquote. He also says, while there has been a handful of studies, I suspect we are first to build the 10-meter telescope to specifically look at this type of solar system body, unquote. And there's even more problems. Another issue with Comet 266P Christensen is that it would have only been visible to the Big Ear radio observatory that captured the WOW signal back in 1977, 55 minutes before the WOW signal was actually detected. I mean, this is all based on math and trajectories and all this. And we didn't know that the comet existed until 2006. So they didn't know it was there back in 1977. But measuring this, this should have happened an hour before the signal was actually detected. So there's a little bit of confusion there. And now there's a third issue that's been raised. And that's with what's called the feed horns. And the feed horns collect the data from these two gates that kind of face each other. And there's little feed horns that collect the signal in the center at the Big Ear Radio Observatory, which is actually no longer standing. The WOW signal was only detected by one of the two horns used to collect the sound. And if it had gone from one and then gone to the other, there would have been a 70-second gap between the horns as the sky rotates overhead. Obviously, we're stuck here on the planet. And as the Earth is spinning its way through space, the sky is going to turn from our perspective. And the only thing that could have happened to kind of explain this is that the signal turned itself on or off, or there was a malfunction of some sort that was never detected with the instrument. Now, Paris admits there's no answer for the feed horn issue, but thinks it was a technical fault of the telescope. Oh, boy. When you start blaming other things, people will speak up. Bob Dixon, who was the director of the SETI program, told the magazine Astronomy Now, quote, "Our telescope was working perfectly normally at the time, and other radio astronomical objects on the same day were observed in both beams," or in other words, in both horns, unquote. Now, despite these three issues working against him, Paris feels confident that his work will stick. He plans on continuing his work with providing an explanation of why we would detect such strong neutral hydrogen emissions from a comet like the one as inactive, as it's described, as 266P Christensen. And hopefully he'll have that work out and published in 2018. I know. Thank you, Paris. Thank you, Antonio, for your hard work. I mean, he's just getting attacked. And, no one ever said science was perfect or that science was easy. But this is science. Peer review. People are asking questions. There's also a Google document that was sent to Antonio Paris via Twitter, which was started by Chris Lintott, who is a professor of astrophysics in the Department of Physics at Oxford University. And this Google Doc also includes questions from other Twitter-based, Twitter-based astronomers, but astronomers that are utilizing Twitter. And there are some really thorough questions about radio astronomy, comets, the actual experiment, as well as the paper that was published that Paris has actually vowed to answer. He's actually excited that people are putting some constructive criticism and constructive questions into actually and to kind of make this information. And personally, I'm looking forward to it because there is one I had and some of that I've read about your observatory since he made this announcement and actually being able to go visit the area where this was in Perkins University, which was the home of the former Big Ear Radio Observatory. I learned a lot about it, and I learned a lot about the functionality of it and how it collected the data and information. So I'm excited to see his reaction to this and how he explains everything in one way or the other. So we'll have to keep an eye on that, and it's going to be interesting. It's going to be a long time, obviously, sometime next year by the time he gets more work done on these comets, but just be patient. Be patient. The answers will come, and science does take a while sometimes. And I'm going to post this information in the chat room, and you can disseminate what you want with that. You can save it for later. You can read it now. Just don't fall asleep. And these links that I'm posting in the chat room live right here as we do the show, I will also be putting into the Facebook feed for the Paranormal News Insider, which is facebook.com/Paranews Insider. And that's connected to my Twitter feed, which is also at Paranews Insider. And you can get that information as you like. And it's not always the popular links that float around when people talk about these stories. Sometimes I don't like those. And I like to go and get ones that have a little bit more information. Kind of just the first ones that people find and they throw it in there. Because sometimes those are not the original stories. They're kind of copies of copies of copies. And sometimes the earliest stuff has usually the best information, or sometimes ones that have been around and collected a little bit more actual information by actual journalists instead of copy and pasters. You get a little bit more information. So that's that. I'm sure this story is going to pop up again in the near future. So what would happen if the wow signal was like, let's say it was a warning, like, hey, you guys got 40 years. We're coming for you. What would we do if there was an alien invasion other than scream and run? Because I know that's a lot of people would do. You know, some people, I'm gonna get my gun and I'm gonna stockpile. I'm gonna go to Walmart and steal water and TVs and shoes, and I'm gonna steal ammunition, and I'm gonna defend the Earth. I'm gonna fly a fighter jet and blow up the mothership. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're gonna run, and you're gonna hide in your mom's basement, and hope that everything blows over, like a lot of people. But what would we seriously do, or how would all this happen? It's a very complicated question. You know, it's simply put on this story, a website called Unilad, and it came out on Sunday. And the story is titled, quote, "How Earth Would Cope with an Actual Alien Invasion," unquote. Sounds simple. It's, you know, how to, okay, this is what's going to happen. Sounds simple, but it's not that simple. It's very complicated. There's many facets to it, many sides of the story. And this side, or this story, explores the topic pretty much by quoting people in various fields about their thoughts on what would happen if we were visited by an intelligent extraterrestrial species. You know, the good, bad, and indifferent. Now, obviously, if you've followed any of this stuff over the years and you've heard of Professor Stephen Hawking, he's not really in favor of this. Theoretical physicist Michio Kaku also is not in favor of this. Pretty much they both state that they would pretty much, here on Earth, we would pretty much be a pushover for anyone coming to Earth, that we have basically no chance. And I know Stephen Hawking in the past pretty much compares it to Columbus discovering the New World. And we know how that turned out. We'd all end up probably running casinos on the new planet for aliens if they took over, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what he meant by that, but it didn't turn out well for the Native Americans, and it probably wouldn't turn out very well for us. Ryan Sprague, the author of Somewhere in the Skies, states, quote, "It would appear that we've been so aggressively conditioned to believe an invasion would be catastrophic and malevolent beyond comprehension that any advanced civilization would come to our planet with an agenda of taking over and using our resources to its advantage. While I can understand this pessimistic view, the decades and decades of possible alien visitation here on the planet already and the countless UFO sightings throughout the world would indicate that if they were to do such a thing, they would have done it already," unquote. Okay. So that's basically saying, well, there's all these UFO sightings, so they're here, so they would have attacked already. Well, let me stop right there. Let me address this, Ryan. Now, you look at our current space program, what are we doing? We're sending out scouts, sending out little probes. We're sending out rovers to Mars. We're not sending out an evasion fleet. We're not sending out our Earth Galactic Empire. You know, we're not sending out soldiers in space. There's no need for that. We haven't found a world to conquer yet. And eventually, when we do, that's probably what we're going to do. We'll send bulldozers and machines that will convert, anything into water. And we'll just decimate planets. We know that's what we would do, but that's just us. But my point is that even an advanced civilization is not going to just send out an army. They're going to send out probes, and maybe that's what's going on. And even though we've technically really only had some really heavy duty UFO sightings just in the last 60, 70 years. I mean, yeah, you can talk about Chariots of Fire way back, not the movie, but Chariots on Fire in the Sky, way back in the Roman times. That's all well and good, but it's not really, you know, UFOs in our context. So even if you do go back a couple thousand years, that's not long enough for an advanced species, even if they do have millions of years of technology behind them, to come here. It's not gonna happen. It doesn't work that way. Space is a lot more vast and a lot more difficult to get through than what it seems like on movies. You know, movies, you just, you know, push the throttle and all the stars turn into a blur. It looks like snow on your windshield and you're there. 10 seconds, unless you're having a deep conversation, then it lasts like minutes, which I never understood. Now, other people with this issue feel that there's really nothing to worry, since it's highly unlikely that aliens could get here, despite the number of purported UFO sightings, pretty much what I just mentioned. UFO skeptic Robert Schaefer brings up a number of good points with his in his portion of this interview, when he says, quote, first, any supposed alien invaders would have to find us, given that they would be at least several light years away in some other solar system and probably much farther than that. Finding us and learning what Earth is like is not so easy. Second, they would need to somehow get here, which is very difficult. Even if we assume they have advanced technology, because fundamental physics tells us that they would need insanely large amounts of energy to accelerate spaceships to relativistic speeds and then to decelerate them when they arrive. Even nuclear fusion power is woefully inefficient compared to what would be needed. If they are bringing along scary armaments and supplies, that's just more mass to add to their armada. Unquote. What do you say about that? He also adds a bit of information about biology when he says it's doubtful that our bodies could survive in an entirely alien biosphere with different parasites, different foods, etc. The same problem would also apply to any alien beings who might come here. Unquote. Well, that makes sense. It makes perfect sense. But it's a lot of information. So just bear with me and kind of digest that for a second. Just think about that. But right now, I want to let you know that you're tuned in to WCJV Digital Broadcasting from Youngstown, New York, emanating live at WCJVradio.com. And you're listening to the Paranormal News Insider with your host from space, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. And let's see what else is going on. Oh, my goodness, I just got lost. There it is. Tomorrow night, Wednesday night, you can catch Paranormal Experience with host Kat Hobson. She's going to have Keith Age. Wow, Keith Age. I met Keith Age 9 years ago, and I talked to him probably longer than that, probably 20 years ago. It's the first time I ever exchanged emails with him. The legendary rock and roll ghost hunter, producer, author, and founder of the Louisville Ghost Hunters Society, Keith Age. That's Paranormal Experience with host Kat Hobson tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern Thursday, in case you're listening on a different day. 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, Wednesday night. Again, right here on WCJVradio.com. www.paranormalnewsinsider.com. So where were we? We were in space. That's where I left you. You know, this whole debate, it's simple. And like I mentioned earlier, I'm writing a book on UFOs, and there's a lot of cultural based stuff on that. And we are fed a lot of information about aliens and alien invasions. And it's hard to even watch a movie anywhere without some sort of context of what would happen if aliens invaded us. There's really nothing you can watch anywhere. I mean, comic book movies, these are all based on alien invasions of some sort. Superman from a different planet. Thor, I mean, yeah, folklore from planet Earth, but supposedly some dude from another planet coming here. So those movies and all kinds of other movies, I mean, Independence Day, Aliens, I mean, I could go on and on for hours just telling you all the movies, Star Wars, movies about space and about invasions and the politics of space and all these other things. So we're fed a lot of this cultural stuff. So it's hard for us to really be able to step back and think about this. And that's why discussions, I have to side with the skeptics. They're giving us facts and information, and it's not so much emotions or fears. I mean, my personal opinion, I mean, we're pretty much, I mean, we're screwed if that does happen. I mean, we don't stand a chance. If some other alien technology can make it to Earth from another planet, despite how they get here, they're much more well advanced than we are, despite our pretty looking cities and our fanciful nuclear tipped bombs and all this stuff that we have. We don't stand a chance. I don't care what the movies show. Some drunk guy flying an F-14 Tomcat's not going to cut it. It's just not. We're not going to win some kind of alien war by transmitting some sort of virus into their computer. That's all just make believe stuff. It's just really not logical that we're going to be able to understand their computer technology or have some USB port that we're going to plug in and whatever. I mean, it's hard for us to relate to that because all we have is what we know here on planet Earth, our perspective on this little rock floating through space. I mean, it's all we have. I mean, again, skeptics, you know, I just read Antonio Paris's book, Space Science, and it's chock full of information about the complexities of space travel, not only with the distance involved, but which was mentioned, the massive amount of energy that's needed and time it would take to travel great distances in the universe. I mean, we're talking thousands of years, even if you could get close to the speed of light, which would increase your chances of hitting things or other things going wrong. I mean, the physiological, psychological effects on the people inside the craft. Not only that, but you have to think about our gravity and atmospheric composition. We're going to have a hard time when we go to Mars. It's going to be much different. It may not be hospitable for alien life, let alone the biology that keeps us alive could instantly kill a being from another system. Same goes for us. There are far too many issues to overcome to expect this to happen, as I would call it, our infancy as a, quote, advanced civilization. But really, I mean, really just step back. Let me just kind of close the story with this thought. I don't think we should be worried about looking upward in fear of destruction for what might come from what might reach us from other planets. But let's look around. Let's look at each other. I mean, if we can't learn how to share this rock, the human species will die off sooner than later at its own hands. And we won't have to worry about some space invader coming here and taking us out or taking all of our stuff. We're going to be back at stone tools for those of us that are left alive. On that note, it wouldn't be too far-fetched to think that we would never give an alien race a chance to show peace or even war, as we'd probably attack them with the slightest move. The first time we saw anything enter the atmosphere, I don't think people are going to sit back and try to gather messages. No, they're going to be launching stuff, telling them to go away. And unfortunately, I think that's the sad truth. That's it. You know, I don't want to, I mean, we could go on and on. I could do an entire like 2-hour show talking about that topic. It's very involved and everyone has an opinion and everyone has a side of thought. And, you know, a lot of us would be freaked out about, you know, a lot of people would be hopeful that, you know, they're going to come and go, you know, just grab our leaders and just smack them in the face and go, what's wrong with you people? And try to give us, you know, a peaceful way to go about our business. But I don't know. I don't think so. If they're traveling great distances, using that much energy, that much resources. They're not going to come here with cupcakes and words of peace and wisdom. They're going to come with lasers and blasters and ditch diggers to take our resources. Sorry. I mean, that's just, again, but that's just our pessimistic Earth view of being these little parasites on this large rock hurtling through space. That being said, other news. We'll try to a little bit more positive news here. Let me grab a link. Here's the I'll throw the article into the chat room so you can kind of read what these guys said without me stuttering through these words. There it is. Boom. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, I made jokes about this. I was at work yesterday, kind of late morning before afternoon, we lost power. And I work in a very large retail environment. And I made jokes about this that, yeah, watch people come kicking our doors in trying to steal water and TVs, things I don't need. Well, I mean, the water you need, but TVs and shoes and things like that. That's why I said that earlier. Because people just need that little reason to riot. People need a little reason to act out of hand, to rock the boat, to kind of go against order. And, you know, order, people being, I should say, being have, and order on this planet are very, very, it's an illusion. It's a very thin line. I mean, look at New Orleans back in Hurricane Katrina. That was a shining and shocking example of what can happen when things go wrong and when people demand that they're taken care of or demand that, you know, that things be put back to the way we're comfortable with. And it doesn't take much for those scales to tip in the favor of those that want to cause chaos and destruction. Because when they do, they will. And there's really not much you can stop. And a lot of those stories that happened weren't really made too much public, scary enough as it is. I had a friend that gave me a lot of inside information about that spooky stuff. Anyway, other news. NASA. You guys, you know those guys. They used to have those space shuttle thingamajiggies. Now they just launch rovers to Mars. NASA. Well, they're going to try again. Yeah, NASA was supposed to launch a rocket last night. And I was kind of bummed out. It was like, kind of, part of me was actually hoping that it would get delayed. And when I found out this morning that it did, I was excited. They were supposed to launch a rocket last night and release canisters that would create fake colored clouds in the sky to test a new ejection system of these canisters, as well as conduct some simple atmospheric experiments. A lot of it dealing with the aurora, but also with the ionosphere. However, due to real clouds, the experiment was rescheduled yet again for tonight. The launch was actually supposed to take place initially back on May 31st, but pretty much everybody knew it's probably not going to happen the first time. These new type of experiments usually have this happen. And I was kind of hopeful that it did because it would cause like a million UFO sightings. And it still will. I mean, even though I'm talking about it here, even though it's news all over the place, it's on TV, it's all over the internet, people are still, you're going to see it tomorrow, all over Twitter, the Twitterverse, all over social media. Oh God, dude, I saw a UFO in the sky, man, off the coast of New Jersey. It's going to happen. And they're going to sound exactly like that. Anyway, May 31st, supposed to launch, but since it's been scrubbed 4 times due to weather conditions, which have to be perfectly clear because they're going to be observing these fake clouds from the ground. And there was one instance where there were boats that were in the vicinity of the splashdown area. And you don't want to be there, folks. If they're going to launch a rocket and they say this is a no-go zone, don't go. There's a 670-pound payload that's going to be dropping into the water. Not something you want to take your little yacht out there with and compete against. Because you think you might be able to get out of the way, but you never know. Now, the warm weather that we're all enjoying here in Ohio, New York, and everywhere else in the Northeast, caused by this latest high-pressure system, is actually a good thing for this. It's going to provide the perfect conditions for the launch. It's going to keep it nice and clear high up into the atmosphere, which is exactly what they need. Some people have accused the government, I know, it's why I made a joke of this, about controlling the weather. I mean, we've all heard that. Oh, yeah, they control the weather. There's this little thing up in Alaska. Yeah, I've heard it a million times. And a lot of people, I've already seen this, people are fearful that this is what's going to happen with this experiment by creating bright artificial clouds. Don't worry, it's nothing major. It's actually been done numerous times. This isn't the first time they've done this. They've been doing it actually for, I think, 60, 70 years now, off and on. It's just in the news. It's popular. It's big. It's going to be cool. Now, the rocket will launch tonight, hopefully, just prior to 9 o'clock, about an hour from now if you're listening live. And about 10 minutes into the flight, give or take, when the rocket's about 96 to about 124 miles above the Earth, it's going to release 10 canisters. They're going to be about the size of a soda or pop can, depending upon where you're from. I don't know. Some people say soda. Some people say pop. Some people say soda pop. I don't know. Whatever. So you get the gist. And quoting from Smithsonian.com, quote, the canisters will release barium, strontium, and cupric oxide, forming colored clouds that researchers can visually monitor and track from the ground, which will help them understand the movements of particles in the ionosphere and aurora, unquote. So these tracer canisters are not harmful to us or the environment, and it's actually most of these things that I've mentioned here, barium, strontium, cupric oxide, they're actually inside or ingredients, I should say, chemicals that are the same as in fireworks. So, but you're not going to see fireworks. It's not what's going to happen. And it's actually going to contain a lot less of these chemicals than typical fireworks would anyway. Now, the chemicals will react with sunlight, which will cause the various colors. And yes, I know somebody thought this. While the sun will be setting, the sun will still be very high in the sky. You won't see it, obviously. There will be some light rays, but it's going to be getting darker. But at the higher altitude, the sun is still there, even though the sky might look darker, even close to black, which at 9 o'clock it won't be. You just don't see it because it just goes through the atmosphere there. But in the thermosphere, where the ionosphere resides, these clouds will still hit that high-level sunlight, and it's going to be beautiful. I'm telling you now, it's going to be a beautiful sight to see these red and green and blue colors that high up in the sky. It's going to look neat. And I don't know. Do you remember from science class that we live in the troposphere, which extends up to about 7 miles? I think there was a song or something I used to sing. I can't remember. But then we have the stratosphere, which extends up to about 30, 31 miles where the ozone layer is at the top of that. Then the mesosphere, which is 50 miles up. And then the thermosphere, which extends all the way up to 440 miles above the surface of the planet. And then the exosphere, which extends out to about 6,200 miles. And the ionosphere, which is a layer of electrons. It's kind of a complicated thing that exists from the thermosphere up to the exosphere. It's, you know, the ionosphere sounds like a level of the atmosphere, but it's actually a separate thing because it's electrons and just these atoms and stuff that's there. So they don't include it as part of the actual atmosphere, but it's confusing. Shouldn't be called sphere or anything, but anyway. This experiment is going to be visible from many areas on the East Coast. Well, if you look up, that is. But we're talking New Jersey, New York City. They're saying even as far south as North Carolina, which is weird because if you kind of do the math, Where I'm sitting now, I should be able to see it, but I really don't think that's going to happen. I'm going to be out. I don't have a telescope, but I've got really good binoculars. I'm going to be out. I'm going to stand up on the roof as long as there's no storm and check this out, but probably not going to see it. But for the rest of us, if you're not in that sighting area or you just don't want to stand up on top of your roof with binoculars, you can tune into NASA TV, which is what I'm going to be doing more than likely. It's a little hot out. And they have a Ustream channel, and you can find that at ustream.tv/NASA HD TV. And if you're not familiar with Ustream, it's the letter U followed by stream dot TV forward slash NASA HD TV. And live streaming will start at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, and the big show should start just a few minutes after 9. I think they said 9:09. Give or take. You can also follow updates on the NASA Twitter feed at NASA underscore Wallops. That's NASA underscore WALLOPS if you're going to watch Twitter feed. Not me. I'm watching Ustream. And I'm going to be throwing some of the coverage. I'll throw these resources as we get closer to a little after 8:30. I'll throw these resources on my Facebook feed at facebook.com/paranewsinsider. If you just want kind of the condensed version of the stuff and you got other stuff to do and you don't want to sit there and watch the Ustream channel, I'll give you some pictures and whatever happens. And that's also tied into my Twitter feed at paranewsinsider. And I'll throw that link in the chat room if you guys are interested in checking this out. And yeah, Ustream, I stream, we all stream. Ustream is I don't know. I didn't think it was still around anymore. Honestly, I used to watch a lot of ghost investigators would put up their cameras on Ustream and do live stuff. But they were choppy. Sometimes people saw stuff that they shouldn't have seen. Anyway, one more story here. And this is kind of an odd story. A little weird. It's a little out there, but it, trust me, it has a little bit to do with the paranormal. It kind of caught my eye. And yeah, it's not necessarily paranormal, but it's strikingly spooky nonetheless. The headline of the story is what kind of caught my eye in the beginning, because it used the word doppelganger. And you don't really see the word doppelganger too much in the media. And if you're not familiar with that, it refers to seeing a lookalike of a living person. Now, in the paranormal, it sometimes occurs with out-of-body experiences. And it's also been noted to happen in haunting cases, where they'll see somebody who's imprinted, but they're still alive and they're somewhere else. Obviously, seeing a lookalike. And some other situations. Now, in psychiatry, the term hodoscopy, I don't know if that's pronounced right, but I've seen it a million times, is used to describe when someone sees a copy of themselves at a distance. But unfortunately, this occurs with epilepsy and schizophrenia. Yeah. The story in question is titled, quote, "Man Freed After 17 Years in Jail When Cops Find His Doppelganger Who Shares the Same Name," unquote. Well, it pretty much sums up the story right there. It's a pretty big story right now. I was surprised. It caught my eye a couple days ago, and now it's all over the place. I'm currently working on a book. I mentioned this, I think, twice now. This will be the third time. On the topic of UFO investigations. And I discussed the topic of how people kind of make bad witnesses, and how DNA exonerations have freed many people since it's come into existence in 1989. Now, our minds can be tricky. They don't work exactly like we think they do. An overwhelming majority of us don't have photographic memories. And even people that do, or at least they claim they do, they don't really understand the limitations of the human brain and how we actually retrieve memories. And while the story I'm going to tell you about here has nothing to do with DNA exoneration, it's important to understand how witness testimony can be wrong quite a bit. And along with that, how the police handle suspects and witnesses, which makes things a lot worse. And a lot of people, and I just saw a story on this from the Smithsonian, that Our memories are not as bad as what many headlines make it, but it's the malleability of our memories is our truest weakness. And what I mean by that is they're really malleable, where the police can lead us in the wrong direction. And that's exactly what happened in this particular story. And again, this isn't really with DNA, but this is a witness problem in this particular story. And I want to just throw this out here. These are some facts from what's called the Innocence Project, which is a nonprofit organization that helps out, helps people that are wrongly accused or wrongly imprisoned, and either tries to get them freed or tries to get the wrongful party convicted. Now, in 1989, the first DNA exoneration took place. This has happened. There's been exonerations in 37 states. Now, 20 of the 350 people, of examples of exonerated people, have served time on death row. The average length of time served by exonerees is 14 years. And if you take these 350 people, that's 4,787 years of time served wrongfully. 26.5 is the average age of exonerees at the time of the wrongful conviction. The average age at exoneration, 42 years old. 71% of these cases involved eyewitness misidentification. 71% of these wrongful cases involved eyewitness misidentification. I can go on and on. There's a lot of good facts. I've read this before, and it's interesting because they update it frequently when they get statistics. You can find more information at innocenceproject.org, and they have a lot of information about what they do and how they do it. And they were involved in this particular story. And this story started outside of a Walmart after a man was seen attempting to steal a purse. And ultimately, he was convicted of aggravated robbery and sentenced to more than 19 years in prison. 19 years in prison based on witness testimony. There was no DNA, no fingerprint evidence collected at the scene to specifically tie this person to the crime. Now, witnesses at the scene of the attempted robbery were reportedly unable to get a good look at the face of the perpetrator, but remembered that he was either Hispanic or light-skinned African-American. Now, in the lineup, police used Richard Anthony Jones, who was the only suspect who actually fit that description. Remember I mentioned malleability of memories. Jones had presented a verified alibi at the time of his arrest, but the witness testimony put him in prison. Yeah, 19 years. Well, that, granted, he wasn't completely innocent as a person. He had a previous record, multiple priors. That's why he was put away a little longer. But this case was obviously handled in a way that went against a fair trial. Now, while Jones was in prison, he had heard about another man named Richard, who went by Ricky, who looked exactly like him. He never saw this guy, but this is what he'd heard. People had told him, wow, you look just like Ricky. Now, he brought this information up to his lawyers, and it was discovered that this Ricky lived near the address of the incident that took place in Kansas City, Kansas, while Richard lived miles away in Kansas City, Missouri. Now, Jones had exhausted his appeals to the case, which were all obviously unsuccessful. But the court decided to hear this new information to, quote, to prevent a manifest injustice, unquote. Well, thanks to the tireless work by the folks at the Innocence Project, Jones is enjoying his first taste of freedom in the 21st century. So a weird story. And, you know, these happen all the time. There was one late last year, same deal. I think the person was in prison twice as long. He got out on a technicality with the DNA evidence. It wasn't his DNA, it was somebody else's DNA, or they proved that it wasn't this person's DNA. So this stuff happens all the time. And I don't know, I have an interest in this for multiple reasons. I love forensics. I love how we tie how we tell stories when nobody's present, because one of the laws of forensics, it's not a law, it's kind of a rule, it's a saying that nobody can enter a place and leave a place without leaving part of you behind. There's always evidence, some sort of trace information that's left behind anytime anybody goes somewhere. And sometimes, you know, when we rely on witnesses, people are malleable. Sometimes people make mistakes, or in the heat of the moment, we just want somebody to pay for the crime. And sometimes, unfortunately, it happens, you know, it's kind of wrong. And now, no one's saying that this gentleman didn't do the crime. It's just that this whole process was wrong, and it's more than likely this other person, this Ricky. But strangely, this Ricky gentleman did not they actually interviewed him, and he said he didn't do the crime. So who knows? It might not have been him either. Could have just been another person that looked similarly like him. So I know, not paranormal. I just thought it was really interesting. And it does kind of tie in to the paranormal because of because of witness testimony, which we all deal with if we're anomalous researchers investigating UFOs, investigating cryptids or ghosts or anything like that, you will deal with witnesses. And sometimes we think, well, this person, I don't think they saw what they think they saw. And collecting data and information, I mean, that's part of what we do as well. So with that being said, I'm going to quickly throw in the book of the week. I only got a couple minutes left, but I have to get this in. And this book is written by Ronald L. Murphy. Let me tell you the quick story. I've said this before because I've done two of his books, On Dogman and On Wildman, former books of the week here on the show. Top-notch books. I mean, just excellent. Can't say excellent enough. The research that goes into these books by Ron Murphy. I met Ron at the Butler Paranormal Convention a couple of years ago. I wasn't speaking. I was actually just manning a table with my books, sitting next to a guy who was selling old books. And he attracted quite a crowd. And I spent like $10. It may not sound like a lot of money, but let's just say I took two trips to the car with the amount of books that I got from him and magazines. Excellent guy. He gave me some stuff for free. It was pretty neat. But I was kind of wedged in there. It was in a building where the speakers were up front and all the vendors were kind of in an L shape around the rest of the room. It's a fairly large room, not the size of an auditorium, but probably half that. And, well, maybe a quarter of that. And I like to listen to people speak. Anytime I go to a convention, whether I'm speaking or not, I still like to enjoy what people have to say. I go there to learn. I go there to network, and just as much as I do to go there and spew about everything that I know. And that particular year, Ron wasn't really on the docket to speak. He wasn't, had been mentioned. It was kind of somebody had canceled a couple of days prior, and Ron was inserted into that spot. And I never heard of this guy. I was like, well, I don't know. It sounds interesting. I've never heard of him, never seen him speak, never heard him speak. So I'm going to give him a shot. I'm going to listen. And normally, I always have a little pad of paper, and I'll take the person's name or the title of their presentation, some of the information about them, and maybe a couple of notes. With Ron's presentation, I think I had 4 or 5 pages, which is probably the most I've done outside of listening to a couple of parapsychologists speak that I was fortunate enough to hear. But excellent information, and just the way he speaks and the way he comes across with his information, he's building stories. It's fantastic to listen to him speak, and it's weird because when you read his book, if you've heard him speak, you hear him telling you the stories, and he engages you just as much in this book as you will in person. And this week's book of the week is called On Ghosts. It's On Ghosts, and it's called On Ghosts, The Spirit World Throughout History. And let me get the link in the chat room, which is what I want to do here. So these guys can check it out, check out the book and where you can get it. On Amazon, and I'll get the cover before Dita, because she likes to race.
Boom.
Beat you. Oh, I can't. It's too long. Eh. Oh, well. Well, she'll get it. She'll figure it out. On Ghosts, Ronald L. Murphy, this week's book of the week. And when I first started talking to him about his books and stuff, we were talking more at the Kecksburg Festival, I think the same year. And he mentioned about this ghost book, and I was like, oh, you wrote a book on ghosts. Well, that's what I've been studying for 20-some-odd years now, and I've done tons of research into the history of ghosts and different things. So it's not that I wouldn't enjoy it or I wouldn't find it interesting. It's just that I've done a lot of research on it, so kind of hard to impress me with stuff like that sometimes. This book is published in 2016, has just over 200 pages. But when you read this book, and it seems like 400, there's just so much information, so much material within the book. It will seem like it's twice as thick. It took me a lot longer to read than I thought it would. And within the book, there's a foreword by Colin Schneider, who is the host of the Crypto Kid radio show right here on WCJV Digital Broadcasting. And I was also surprised and happy to see my name listed in the introduction of the book as an inspiration to Ron for part of this book. I was kind of very moved by that. I don't think I've ever been in anybody's introduction for anything. So it was really neat to see that. And I'm not going to kiss up on the thing any much for that, for being included in the introduction. But I can't say enough good stuff about this book. If you've read any of Ron's books, he kind of intertwines his personal experiences with the concepts of history and folklore that he's exploring, with you, that he's talking about. And it just brings you in that much more when you're reading about his personal stuff and how it relates to the topics, emotionally, mentally, and even physically about some of these topics. And some people like those true ghost story types of books. Not my thing. But this kind of gives you that feel a little bit. And I can relate it to John Kachuba, which is one of my favorite ghost authors. He does the same thing. And so I personally really enjoy that when people are able to take their personal experiences and tie it into the personal stuff instead of just coming across dry with material and just throwing fact after fact or research topic after research topic, and you kind of get bored with it. Not this book. I mean, it's really put together very thoroughly. When you read through it and you step back, it paints a picture and it puts the puzzle together throughout history. Now, I mentioned that I've researched a lot, and I've written quite a bit on the history of ghosts in different books and different blogs, and I've talked a lot about it at different presentations through the years. And a lot of the books that I've read on the history of ghosts, a lot of them start with 1848, the Fox sisters, the spiritualism era, and all that stuff. And they move forward, and with good reason. A lot of that is because, at least for me, is because that's the beginning of where the interest became so much that scientists said, okay, enough with this. Let's start studying it. But the reality of it is, that's not where ghosts started. That's not where the story begins. The story begins way, way further back, much further, much, much further. And Ron does exactly as he should, and I was hopeful that he would, because I've presented about this. The same thing where he starts is with the burial practices of our ancient human ancestors, and I was very impressed by this. I was excited to read that because I've never seen anybody else do that, never seen anybody else mention that. That this is really where ghosts start, is when we became self-aware and we became aware of a family, of tribes, or whatever you want to call it, of people that we're related to and taking care of them. And there's different reasons for the burial process. But again, very impressed to see that. And yeah, you're going back a long time. And I've even in my presentations, I've mentioned stories of Romans and Greeks who were the first to document and investigate ghost stories. But man, Ron, he fills in the blanks a lot, talking about the Egyptians, Islamic ghosts. See, there was the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, And even the Asian concept of ghosts, which is the name of one of those chapters, which I really enjoyed that as well, because you truly never see that anywhere. And he even dips his toes in the ocean for a chapter on ghosts of the sea, which is, I wasn't expecting that. Because when I read the book, I got to be honest, I didn't want to look at the chapters. I did read the foreword by Colin and the introduction, but then I didn't want to see the chapters. I just wanted to dig in and read it. Because again, I've done research on this and I've written about it and I've talked about it. So I just wanted to be surprised. And I really was surprised. There was so much information that I never even contemplated would be even in this book. And it's all valuable information. You don't realize it until you get to the next chapter. Like, okay, that really ties into this and this ties into that. And it tells a story that you're not going to find anywhere else. And there is he does talk about the history of Halloween, which is, again, another nice surprise. It was great. But he has a chapter on ghosts in the modern world, which is you kind of have to. And one thing that jumps out to me, which is I wish I could remember when I heard this first. But there's a story in this book that he talks about a man named Harry Martindale in York, England. This is an incident that happened in 1953. Harry was in his basement and saw a Roman chariot and a driver pass through, and they were carrying the short swords and shields and stuff. He heard it and he saw it. And when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, I remember reading about this. I wish I remember where, but it was a fantastic story. And he relates it to a potential time slip, which is could be haunting, could be a number of things. And it was just really refreshing to see that, because I haven't seen that printed anywhere in a long time. And he also talks about EVPs and some of the modern day technology, which, I don't know. I'm not really a big fan of all that stuff, but he does a fantastic job of just tying everything together, the past and the present and everything in between. And again, just a lot of surprises. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of good books on the history of ghosts. One of them that I truly love is Deborah Blum's Ghost Hunters, which covers the history of the SPR and William James. I've got one from the United Kingdom called The Search for Ghosts, which was written, I think, in the 1970s. Excellent resource. And I've got a lot of parapsychology books that talk about the history of psychical research and all that stuff. But nothing is going to prepare you to understand the history and culture of ghosts other than On Ghosts by Ronald L. Murphy. I mean, he just does a fantastic job of going back in the past and bringing it all together. And I'm a researcher, so I thoroughly enjoy it. I don't know if you're not really into the research aspect, that's fine. But there's still some interesting stories that are just scattered throughout this book that really tie that information. It's not just facts of this happened, that happened, this is this, and this is that. There are really good facts and information. And again, some personal stories in there that he sprinkles in that to just kind of tie things to our concepts now and how fear works and all that stuff and through his personal experiences. But just I can't say enough. Excellent book and excellent resource that will definitely come in handy if I continue to write about ghosts. It's definitely something that I'll be leaning on for information. So again, On Ghosts, The Spirit World Throughout History by Ronald L. Murphy, this week's book of the week. And okay, that's in the chat room there. So that is that. Let me get a little special thing I do for these guys. I got a little thing I throw in the chat room at the end of every show. It's kind of cool. Let's get rid of this. Let's get rid of that. And I want to thank everybody that's in the tuned in for the chat room tonight. I really appreciate all you guys coming out. It's always great to see people. And I know, I really don't make too good of a habit of poking my head in here too much, because if I do, I'll get distracted and I'll just start reading all this stuff. And my goodness, got to get this stuff out of here. But anyway, appreciate everybody for tuning in. Even if you're not live in the chat room, that's fine. As long as you're listening, I know you're listening. And again, really appreciate that. Let me throw this in there. That's our little picture. I do these little pictures that wraps up the show. And that's a pretty cool one. I like that one. Anyway, again, huge thanks to everybody that tuned in tonight live or otherwise. And if you're listening to the archive, I appreciate you just the same. I get it. We all have things going on. We have lives. It's nice out, summertime. So, you know, enjoy the weather. 75 degrees in here. I'm doing all right. It's not too bad. And huge thanks to Cindy, my producer, who I've, when I was sick, I put her through all kinds of stuff, having to produce the show to make it sound good. And she does such a fantastic job, for not just for me, but for everybody here on the network. And to Dita and Paul, welcome back, Paul, for the help in the chat room, keeping everybody, all the cats corralled. People get a little out of hand sometimes, and they do a fantastic job of slapping hands, making sure everyone's orderly. No, everyone does a great job in the chat room. And for that, I guess that's it. I'll see you next week. But for now, definitely tonight between 8:30 and 9 o'clock. Keep your eyes in the skies if you're out east. Keep your ears in the woods. Keep the hair standing on the back of your neck. And always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.
Listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.